So I'll give some thoughts about Amitabha. I'll say a little bit about what we might mistake for love. And then I'll make some suggestions, some personal suggestions really, about what the word actually means in the context of our Buddhist practice. And primarily this talk is meant to be from my own experience. So I'll be talking about love for others, and of course love for myself. And along the way I'll be referring to this interesting experience that befell me just before the Sangha retreat and was instrumental in me not being there. So all will be revealed about that finally. So first of all, about the love of Amitabha, the Buddha Amitabha. I'm going to start with a quote. So there will be several quotes in this talk. And this one is from Sangharakshita's compilation, Crossing the Stream, which is, if you know it, is a rather quirkily poetic set of reflections on Dharma life. So he says, in reference to Amitabha, he says, "Everything is perfumed with the fragrance of true suchness. Even the meanest and vilest of things enshrines immaculately within itself the jewel of enlightenment of Buddhahood. The slumbering seed is stirred into wakefulness by the light and warmth of that energetic wisdom compassion, that bright effluence of the essence of reality, of voidness, which is personified as the Bodhisattva, as the universal Buddha, or as Amitabha." So that's quite poetic, isn't it? So here's another quote, also from Sangharakshita, and less flowery. This one's from A Guide to the Buddhist Path. And this is on the all-distinguishing wisdom of Amitabha, which is Amitabha's particular brand of wisdom in the archetypal scheme of things. So Bhante says, "The mirror, as we have seen, reflects all things equally, but at the same time does not confuse or blur their distinctive features. The mirror will reflect the tiniest detail. This is very important. It means that the enlightened mind does not see things only in their unity or only in their diversity, but sees both together." End of quote. So for me, what this seems to say is that the wisdom of Amitabha helps us to love human beings for their intriguing way of being, in some ways the same as ourselves, whilst in other ways fascinating and delightful in their differences and their precious diversity. And this diversity is something that always amazes me and that I personally celebrate, both here in our Sangha and in people in general. So, a word about terminology during this talk. So, I'd like to refer throughout the talk, and quite unapologetically, to love. So, just the simple word love, rather than, as I did in leading that meditation, loving kindness or even the Sanskrit word metta. And I think that for me it's the simplest and best word to describe what, when my experience is the most positive, I feel for my fellow human beings. Or at the very least for some of them. And of course the usual cautions, the usual terminological cautions apply. So you'll know already that I'm not talking about romantic love. I'm not talking about Greek love, incidentally. Part of what I shall be talking about, and I'm going to borrow a song title here, is the love of the common people. And in some ways, this is the most important thrust of what I'd like to say. So another quote, so we've moved on from Amitabha here, but it's still about love. It comes from Sangharakshita's survey of the organization of the Buddhist canon, which I can recommend, The Eternal Legacy. So this poetic passage, if you're interested, is from the Itivutika, which is found in the Kudaka Nikaya of the Pali canon. And it says, "None of the means employed to acquire religious merit, O monks, has a 16th part of the value of love. Love, which is freedom of heart, absorbs them all. It glows, it shines, it blazes forth. And in the same way, O monks, as the light of all the stars has not a 16th part of the value of the moonlight, but the moonlight absorbs it and glows and shines and blazes forth. In the same way again, as at night's end the morning star glows and shines and blazes forth, so, O monks, none of the means employed to acquire religious merit has a 16th part of the value of love. Love, which is freedom of heart, absorbs them all. It glows, it shines, it blazes forth. And in the same way, O monks, as at the end of the rainy season the sun, rising into the clear and cloudless sky, banishes all the dark spaces and glows and shines and blazes forth, so, O monks, none of the means employed to acquire religious merit has a 16th part of the value of love. Love, which is freedom of heart, absorbs them all. It glows, it shines, it blazes forth. So those are some general thoughts about what we mean by love, or what in the Buddhist tradition we refer to as love. But I'd like to say a few words about what we could confuse for love if we're not careful. And here's another quote going back to that compilation, Crossing the Stream. So Sangharakshita says, "We may only too easily delude ourselves that we are cultivating love and compassion when we are in fact increasing our desires and attachments." And another one from the same source. "The sad truth is that it's far less troublesome to indulge in ecstasies of love and admiration for some bloodless abstraction, like humanity, than it is to love for one moment sincerely, unselfishly, and above all practically, even a single imperfect human being, with all his unreasonable demands, his baseless suspicions, his little misunderstandings and petty jealousies." And somebody else who made a similar caution was Padmavajra. Padmavajra is one of the men's ordination team at Padmaloka in Norfolk. And in 2004, he gave one of his many, many talks. This one was called Introducing the Great Love. And in that talk, he warns us to beware of, and I quote, "a sentimental mood of loving everybody." So these various cautions are all, I think, helpful. And I'd like to be clear that I agree that it's pretty meaningless to think we can feel some all-encompassing universal love for all, at least on this side of awakening. However, what we can do is we can look at our specific relationships and look at whether we already recognize love within them, or at least see the potential for there being love within them. And the Metta Bhavana meditation, which we've just done, is so helpful, I think, because of the way that it looks at all the categories of relationship that we can be involved in. With ourselves, with people we already feel close to, with people who are, you might say, just part of the scenery, and those that we're struggling with. And that still leaves the final stage, where we can still indulge our idealism, but from a foundation of actual experience in the preceding four. So going back to Padmavajra and his talk, the Metta Bhavana isn't about that, quote, sentimental mood of loving everybody, but rather about seeing our potential to love anyone. After all, it's only in recognizing our potential that we can consider how to make it reality. So if that gives you a little flavour of what maybe love isn't, then moving on to some thoughts about what love is. So, some general thoughts about love in the context of Buddhist practice. So to begin with, we know that it's related to compassion and to sympathetic joy and to equanimity within the formulation that we call the Brahma Viharas, or we could call them the sublime abodes. And If you're not familiar with that compilation, that formulation, briefly, we can say that compassion arises when our love for somebody encounters their suffering. We can say that we experience sympathetic joy when our love encounters their joy or happiness. And equanimity, the fourth part of the formulation and probably the most misunderstood one, also has the flavour of love, but it's very interesting in that it's a love that isn't overwhelmed by the experience of suffering or hopelessly intoxicated by the experience of joy. So it's steady and it's resilient in its nature. So in our tradition, love is actually seen as being intrinsic to awakening. According to Sangharakshita, the experience of enlightenment itself is described as, amongst many other things, a state of intense, profound, overflowing love and compassion. And then again, there's an ethical dimension to love. So Bhante tells us that skillful action, kusala karma, arises from what he calls certain skillful mental states, including love. He says, the moral life becomes a question of acting from our widest and most comprehensive love and compassion. And specifically, the qualities of the ethical dimension of our communication with other people. So that's right speech in the context of the Noble Eightfold Path, include its being affectionate or loving. In Sanskrit, translation into Sanskrit, Priyavardhita, and there he is. And once again, in A Guide to the Buddhist Path, Sangharakshita says, Maitri, so that's the Sanskrit for love, is not just an emotional feeling, but Maitri as embodied in deeds, as put into actual practice. It is not enough simply to feel good towards others. It must be expressed in action. Otherwise, if we simply gloat over it in our own mind, thinking how much we love everybody and how kind we are, it becomes a sort of emotional self-indulgence, not to say something worse. This is Bhante speaking. So we should watch ourselves in that request, in that respect. And that echoes the point made by Padmavajra that I mentioned just now, but adds the vital ingredient of actually doing things that express our love for others, or we might say equally ourselves. So I'd like to add my own view of what love is to the observations that have come from Padmavajra and from Bhante. So in simple terms, if we accept the universal law of conditionality, and I guess, you know, if we're Buddhists, we do, that all things are completely dependent on all others, then that idea of interdependency includes our relationships with any other human beings with whom we interact. Our lives as they stand are defined by all of those human beings. In terms of our lives moving forward positively, it just can't happen without those people. We need them. And love is our response to our recognizing that need. Again, this recognition isn't all that helpful if it's something like a generalized romantic feeling. We need, and I really mean need, to identify with real individuals and to get involved with them. And I'll elaborate on what the implications of that need to be involved might be just a little bit later. So, about the Metta-Bhavana meditation. So in talking about the Metta-Bhavana and how I see it applying to my real life, I want to mention again some thoughts from Padmavajra from his talk Introducing the Great Love. So he talks about the relationship of the Metta-Bhavana to other meditations. He says when Sangharakshita first taught it in the 1960s, it was considered revolutionary, even though it's a very traditional Buddhist practice. He noted that long after that time, i.e. when Padmavajra spoke in the 1990s, some people still emphasized just mindfulness and insight meditation practices, and perhaps thought that metta is somehow elementary or beside the point. However, there's a danger, this is Padmavajra speaking, there's a danger with mindfulness practice that if not done properly, it can lead to a very dry experience, which is removed from actual everyday experience and is quite disconnected from people. Metta Bhavana is a very good balancing practice for any one-sidedness. In doing it, you're becoming more aware of feeling and emotion. You're contacting, developing, and cultivating your, quote, basic natural friendly responses to more and more people. So, most of you will remember Bhante's very famous quote, "The central problem of the spiritual life for most people is finding emotional equivalents for intellectual understanding." In other words, the real issue is not knowing, but being. Padmavajra goes on to share some thoughts about the qualities of the Metta Bhavana, saying that it's an honest practice. We need to acknowledge our actual feelings. Furthermore, although we can't practically pretend that people are all one, doesn't really mean anything to say that, it is ultimately a non-dual meditation because it contributes to the breaking down of our usual but at the same time poisonous delusion that we're completely separate from others. So I'd now like finally to bring all of these observations very much down to earth. So, over the early May bank holiday weekend this year, I had a fascinating opportunity to examine my own ideas about love and its cultivation through the Metta Bhavana. Around that time, I'd been telling myself and my friends in the order that I thought the most fruitful part of my personal Dharma practice, and Sakyamuni referred to this in introducing me, was the very practice of love towards the wide variety of human beings. And then out of the blue, I had a dramatic and unexpected chance to test that claim. So the background story, which I've told to many Sangha members, has also been a bit prone to Chinese whispers, I think. So this is the authorized version now. So around that time, in May, my partner and I took on a rescue dog, a young and frisky but full-grown and very strong black German shepherd dog. And the day after we adopted him, and that's to say on a Saturday, I took him for a local walk with Gaynor. Gaynor is my 26-year-old daughter. As the three of us walked through a country park near where I live, we came to a tiny, shallow stream. Hudson, that's the dog's name, was thirsty and bolted into the water. I was firmly attached to him by his lead, and before I knew it, I'd been jerked down the small bank, losing my footing completely and landing face down across the stream. When I staggered out, I realised that my trousers were badly torn and had quite a lot of blood running out of the leg. And just like in the TV programme Casualty, pulling back the clothing revealed the full horror of the injury. So I had a 17-centimetre gash in my shin, part of which was all the way down to the bone. My daughter was very calm and collected. She immediately phoned 999, and then she waited a considerable time for the ambulance to arrive at the nearest bit of the road to where the accident happened. Once the ambulance had shown up, she led the dog, whom she'd never even met before that afternoon, the mile or so back to our house. I was taken off to my local hospital, where some hours later I was admitted to an orthopaedic ward pending an operation under general anaesthetic the following day, which happened to be the Sunday of the bank holiday. So those are the facts of the matter. So now you know, if you didn't. So how does that relate to the talk? So in the 48 hours that followed, I was able to look closely at my relationship to the various stages of the Metta Bhavana. Because after all, in a sense, I didn't have a great deal else to do. So regarding the first stage, I pondered the question, do I really love myself? And this is clearly a big question, not just for me, but probably for you as well. And I'd like to come back to that one in a moment. The second stage, just moving on, is about cherishing our friends. And I chose to consider the role of family in this, despite the advice that we usually give when teaching the Metta Bhavana to beginners. So I was deeply impressed, and not for the first time by any means, by my daughter's care for me at the time of the actual accident, and in the hours spent around casualty, which were several. And later on the ward, I received a call from my son in Gloucestershire, soon after I texted him to say what had happened. I was touched, as so often I am, by the care and concern of my partner. And having her visit me each evening just tangibly lifted my spirits. And I was also delighted by how many Buddhist friends sent me concerned and supported texts. You might have been one of those. Just as they had, incidentally, when I was in hospital 9 months earlier for very different reasons. And of course, I hardly need to say that when we recognise or recall what our friends or family have done for us, the healthy response is to express our gratitude to them. I was alluding to that in leading the meditation, wasn't I? And when we express that gratitude, our positive responses to those second stage people, as we can call them, are in turn reinforced. And I read something that really resonated with me in this area in Maitreya Bandhu's excellent book, The Journey and the Guide. I'm sure some of you are currently reading it, as I am. So in the chapter on positive emotion, he says this: gratitude is a quintessentially adult emotion. It is our awareness of being in receipt of things. The key is awareness. Awareness of being given to, loved, nurtured, or befriended. And this got me thinking that this is a really important area where love is concerned. And the thought was reinforced for me personally last week when my friends in the Heart Cooler here at the Buddhist Centre rejoiced in my merits on the occasion of my birthday. That's something we regularly do in the Heart Cooler. When we're sufficiently aware of people to recognise that we're loved by them, that increases our love for them. And so things hopefully go round in a sort of positive feedback loop. Just an aside here, if it's one of your children we're talking about here, you'll have a tricky time. My daughter was embarrassed when I expressed my appreciation of her, which of course demonstrates a natural law concerning the embarrassment unfailingly caused to children of all ages by their parents, whatever those parents might do. Some of you will recognise that universal law. And then the third stage, so moving on to the third stage of the Metta Bhavana. In a way, the really interesting part of the accident and the hospital experiences was in this area. So being open and finding ways to make a connection. Talking about random dog walkers offering their help as I sat waiting for the ambulance. The reassuring practicality and humour of the paramedics. The clear communication and competence of people working in casualty and the X-ray department. Simple humanity of the ward staff. I'd especially like to mention a guy called Lawrence, who was a young nurse who was working 12-hour shifts and had to take my observations every hour or so, and still found time to flatter my partner by saying she looked nothing like 50. Other patients, simple kindness like wishing me good luck as I was wheeled to the operating theatre. A man in the next bed who is an almost 100-year-old, he'll be 100 by now, assuming he's still with us. I think it's so important to be able to find a sense of solidarity with relative strangers, recognizing in them at least some of the basic needs that we ourselves have. For example, trying to get through the demands of the working day by using humour and a generally good-natured mode of communication as a means of sweetening what might in some ways be quite a tough remit. And don't get me wrong, by the way, I'm not suggesting, not for one moment, that my work in the Buddhist Centre is remotely as demanding or valuable as the jobs done by paramedics or nurses. It just doesn't come close. In a way, the challenge of the third stage of the Metta Bhavana is to discover and cultivate a sense of solidarity, as I've said, with people we hardly know. And by extension, with the huge majority of human beings. And here I'd like to recall my earlier point about our idealistic love needing to be converted into practical and pragmatic action. Love for our fellow human beings often involves witnessing their suffering. Whether they're being held as human shields by Islamic State fascists, or trying to find safety within the rule of law in the European Union, or facing the terror of fire in a London tower block, or shivering on the streets of Manchester city centre. I don't think we can profess to have love for our fellow human beings and at the same time choose not to have awareness of their trying to survive conditions that would be a hell realm to us if we were in them. I don't mean that we have to wring our hands in anxiety about the suffering of the world, but neither do I mean that we protect ourselves by opting for willful unawareness. The fact that people are suffering changes our world for the worse, and we have a responsibility to question how we can best act to change it for the better. So this brings us in the usual way to the fourth stage. So of course not everybody I met in that hospital experience was charming and easily lovable. This being the NHS. So, bless it. So, I've already suggested that the fourth stage is about actively looking for whatever love may be present, and I was able to try that out. So some of the staff sometimes seemed offhand or angry with their conditions or more interested in gossiping amongst themselves than in making any sort of connection with the patients. And frankly, it wasn't easy to like those people. In fact, in some cases, I felt quite a reactive response of dislike. But it wasn't impossible by a long way to feel some sort of human connection with them. After all, there were hints of their suffering. So, for example, the cleaner who was moaning that she had twice her normal workload because it was a bank holiday. Or the nurse who seemed to have had a difficult time bumping into her ex over the weekend and had a very public conversation with her colleagues about it. Or the two porters who wheeled me from casualty to the ward without once acknowledging my existence because they were having an angry discussion about how they felt their supervisor wasn't doing his job properly. The fifth and the last stage of the Metta Bhavana can also be pretty challenging. And I think how we make sense of it is down to our individual imaginations. I do think that in all of these interactions that I've described, I had a strong sense of my having a fairly passive part in a sort of drama that had loads of players, only some of whom I actually interacted with directly. I had no choice but to give myself up to the good intentions, professionalism, and kindness of those players, without whom I would have been in much bigger trouble. Maybe this sort of way of looking at the fifth stage is a helpful one. Looking for ways of remembering that our happiness is entirely dependent upon more and more people that make up the complex human systems on which we have no choice but to depend. I had this in mind soon after my hospital stay when I talked to an alcoholic relative of mine. And he's a devout atheist, and he was expressing the difficulty he has with the idea of other power that features in the classic 12-step addiction recovery program. And I gently suggested to him that in reality, we just are dependent on so much more than ourselves, absolutely regardless of how comfortable we feel about that. Just as when I was wheeled off to the operating theatre to have complete strangers rearrange my body while I was out cold, there often isn't any viable alternative but to trust and surrender. We're nearly there. So, I said that I'd go back to that all-important first stage. And what did I conclude about my love for myself from all of that, or from all of this? To quote the famous Vietnamese Zen practitioner, Thich Nhat Hanh, the real point of love is to love ourselves. And in a different part of the Buddhist tradition, the Shambhala tradition, the American nun Pema Chodron says this about self-love. She says, "But loving kindness, maitri, toward ourselves doesn't mean getting rid of anything. Maitri means we can still be crazy after all these years. We can still be angry after all these years. We can still be timid or jealous or full of feelings of unworthiness. The point is not to try to change ourselves. Meditation practice isn't about trying to throw ourselves away and become something better. It's about befriending who we are already. The ground of practice is you or me or whoever we are right now, just as we are. That's the ground, that's what we study, that's what we come to know with tremendous curiosity and interest." And I often think that I have some real issues with self-love. I'm probably not alone, and that may often be true. There are plenty of things in my past conditions that are only too ready to rear their heads in response to all sorts of triggers, usually trivial ones, and tell me that I'm not clever or attractive or skillful or even much of a Buddhist practitioner. However, as part of my bank holiday experience, I had the time to look at myself just as much as at the people around me. I noticed that when I was in trouble, I managed to care for myself by thinking clearly, not panicking, and not being overwhelmed by anxiety or fear. I kept my sense of humour. There's a great example of this. A junior doctor drew a big arrow in black marker pen here to point to a 17 centimetre wound here. I hope you got that bit, Michael. So that was quite funny. And I remembered to be supportive and grateful to the people that I met. I didn't feel sorry for myself. I made the best of the time available. And I thoroughly enjoyed the opportunity to read a novel, listen to Radio 3 in the middle of the night, or just doze. And in a sense, in a strange sense, I had a real sense that life was good. Things could be a lot worse than spending endless hours in bed with a couple of simple pleasures and no decisions to make beyond when next to go to the toilet. It's even easier than being on retreat. So to finish, I'm just going to repeat that beautiful quote from the Eternal Legacy, from the Itivutaka. "So none of the means employed to acquire religious merit, O monks, has a 16th part of the value of love. Love, which is freedom of heart, absorbs them all. It glows, it shines, it blazes forth. And in the same way, O monks, as the light of all the stars has not a 16th part of the value of the moonlight, but the moonlight absorbs it and glows and shines and blazes forth. In the same way, again, as at night's end the morning star glows and shines and blazes forth, so, O monks, none of the means employed to acquire religious merit has a 16th part of the value of love. Love, which is freedom of heart, absorbs them all. It glows, it shines, it blazes forth. And in the same way, O monks, as at the end of the rainy season, the sun, rising into the clear and cloudless sky, banishes all the dark spaces and glows and shines and blazes forth. So, O monks, none of the means employed to acquire religious merit has a 16th part of the value of love. Love, which is freedom of heart, absorbs them all. It glows, it shines, it blazes forth. Thank you very much.